earn your fair share of the returns in the stock and bond markets, even as they do in all financial markets. Indeed, many of the earlier chapters in this book that were focused on stock funds could just as easily be the titles of a series of bond fund chapters, especially Focus on the Lowest Cost Funds, Selecting Long-Term Winners, and Profit from the Majesty of Simplicity and Parsimony. These rules are universal. Don't take my word for it. The power of bond indexing is growing. Peter Fisher, former head of the fixed income group at giant global money manager BlackRock, has observed, "We're moving to the second phase of the index revolution. The world is a frightening, uncertain place, and investors want to make their bond portfolios much simpler so they can sleep at night. While not a lot has been written about the remarkable, and remarkably obvious, value of index funds that invest in bonds, the convictions expressed in this chapter have been strongly reinforced by Walter R. Good, CFA, and Roy W. Hermanson, CFA, in Index Your Way to Investment Success. Comparison of expenses, transaction costs, and, where applicable, sales loads identify the cost advantage for bond index funds. For the actively managed load funds, the index fund advantage amounts to 1.2 percentage points per year. The data provide a sobering glimpse of the challenge encountered by the active bond fund manager, and suggest how much additional return active management may have to add, on average over an extended period, just to break even. Further confirmation comes from across the pond. England's Tim Hale, author of Smarter Investing, Simpler Decisions for Better Results, writes, "You should not overlook the efficacy of index investing for bonds, which up to now has been whispered rather than shouted from the rooftops. The evidence is compelling and comes down firmly in favor of investing in index funds. Over the 10-year period, 1988 to 1998, U.S. bond index funds returned 8.9% a year against 8.2% for actively managed bond funds, with index funds beating 85% of all active funds. This differential is largely due to fees." Chapter 15. The Exchange Traded Fund, ETF. A Traitor to the Cause? During the past decade, the principles of the traditional index fund, TIF, have been challenged by a sort of wolf in sheep's clothing, the Exchange Traded Fund, ETF. Simply put, the ETF is an index fund designed to facilitate trading in its shares, dressed in the guise of the traditional index fund. If long-term investment was the paradigm for the original TIF designed 42 years ago, surely using index funds as trading vehicles can only be described as short-term speculation. If the broadest possible diversification was the original paradigm, surely holding discrete, even widely diversified, sectors of the market offers far less diversification and commensurately more risk. If the original paradigm was minimal cost, then this is obviated by holding market sector index funds that carry higher costs, entail brokerage commissions when they are traded, and incur tax burdens if one has the good fortune to trade successfully. But let me be clear. There is nothing wrong with investing in those indexed ETFs that track the broad stock market, just so long as you don't trade them. While short-term speculation is a loser's game, long-term investment is a proven strategy, one that broad market index funds are well-positioned to implement. ETF traders have absolutely no idea what relationship their investment returns will bear to the returns earned in the stock market. The quintessential aspect of the original paradigm of the TIF is to assure, indeed virtually guarantee, that investors will earn their fair share of the stock market's return. ETF traders, however, have nothing remotely resembling such a guarantee. In fact, after all of the selection challenges, timing risks, extra costs, and added taxes, ETF traders can have absolutely no idea what relationship their investment returns will bear to the returns earned in the stock market. These differences between the traditional index fund, the TIF, and the index fund Nouveau, represented by the ETF, are stark. Refer to Exhibit 15.1 in the accompanying PDF. Exchange-traded funds march to a different drummer than the original index fund. In the words of the old song, I am left to wonder, what have they done to my song, Ma? The creation of the spider. The first U.S. exchange-traded fund, created in 1993 by Nathan Most, was named Standard & Poor's Depositary Receipts, SPDRs, and quickly dubbed the spider. It was a brilliant idea. Investing in the S&P 500 index, operated at low cost with high tax efficiency, priced in real time but held for the long term, it held the prospect of providing ferocious competition to the traditional S&P 500 index fund. The late Mr. Most, a fine man, initially offered to partner with Vanguard using our S&P 500 index fund as the trading vehicle. Since I see trading as a loser's game for investors and a winner's game for brokers, I declined his offer. But we parted friends. Brokerage commissions, however, made it less suitable for investors making small investments regularly. The Spider 500 remains the largest ETF, with assets of more than $240 billion in early 2017. During 2016, some 26 billion shares of the Spider S&P 500 were traded, a total dollar volume of an amazing $5.5 trillion, and an annual turnover rate of 2,900%. In terms of dollar volume, every day the Spider was the most widely traded stock in the world. Spiders and other similar ETFs are primarily used by short-term investors. The largest users, holding about one-half of all ETF assets, are banks, active money managers, hedgers, and professional traders who trade their ETF shares with a frenzy. These large traders turned over their holdings at an average rate of nearly 1,000% in 2016. ETF growth explodes. From that single S&P 500 ETF, ETFs have grown to account for fully half of the asset base of all index funds. As 2017 began, $2.5 trillion of the $5 trillion total. That 50% market share is up from 41% in 2007 and only 9% in 1997. ETFs have become a force to be reckoned with in the financial markets. The dollar volume of their trading sometimes constitutes as much as 40% or more of the total daily trading volume on the entire U.S. stock market. ETFs have proved to meet the needs of investors and speculators alike, but they have also proved to be manna from heaven for stockbrokers. The amazing growth of ETFs certainly says something about the energy of Wall Street's financial entrepreneurs, about the focus of money managers on gathering assets, about the marketing power of brokerage firms, and about the willingness, nay, eagerness, of investors to favor complex strategies and aggressive trading, continuing to believe, against all odds, that they can beat the market. We shall see. The ETF stampede. The growth of ETFs has approached a stampede, not only in number but in diversity. There are now more than 2,000 ETFs available, up from 340 a decade ago, and the range of investment choices available is remarkable. As of this writing, some 250 more ETFs have been launched in the past 12 months, and some 200 have gone out of business. The high rate of ETF launches and closures suggests a new investment fad. Such fads have rarely enhanced the well-being of investors. The profile of ETF offerings differs radically from the profile of TIF offerings, referred to Exhibit 15.2 in the accompanying PDF. For example, only 32% of ETF assets are invested in broadly diversified stock market index funds, U.S. and international, such as the Spider, compared to fully 62% of TIF assets. There are 950 ETFs offering concentrated, speculative, inverse, and leveraged strategies holding 23% of ETF assets. But there are only 137 such TIFs, holding 5% of TIF assets. There are also 669 ETFs focused on smart beta and factor strategies, 244 based on stock market sectors, and 156 concentrating their assets in particular foreign countries. There are also 196 broad-based bond ETFs and 422 utilizing high leverage, enabling speculators to bet on the stock market's direction and then double, triple, or even quadruple daily swings in the stock market, tracking commodity prices and currencies, and using other high-risk strategies. What is more, investor cash flows into ETFs are exceptionally volatile, especially when compared to the relatively stable cash flows experienced by TIFs. During the 24 months from the stock market high in April 2007 to April 2009, shortly after the low of the 50% market crash, TIFs experienced not a single month of negative flows. Flows into ETFs, however, were negative in 10 of the 24 months, ranging from inflows of $31 billion in December 2007, near the market's high, to outflows of $18 billion in February 2009, when stock prices hit bottom. Counterproductive investor behavior writ large. Yes, in almost every respect, most ETFs have strayed far from the concepts of buy and hold, diversification, and rock-bottom cost that are exemplified by the traditional index fund. The renowned Purdy shotgun is great for big-game hunting in Africa. It's also an excellent weapon for suicide. Broad market ETFs constitute the only instance in which an ETF can replicate and possibly even improve on the five paradigms listed earlier for the original index fund, but only when they are bought and held for the long term. Their annual expense ratios tend to be comparable to their TIF counterparts, although their transaction commissions erode the returns that investors earn. The early advertisements for the SPDR claimed, "Now you can trade the S&P 500 all day long, in real time." And so you can. But to what avail? I can't help likening the ETF, a cleverly designed financial instrument, to the renowned Purdy shotgun, supposedly the world's best. The Purdy may be great for big game hunting in Africa, but it's also an excellent weapon for suicide. I suspect that too many ETFs will prove, if not suicidal to their owners in financial terms, at least wealth depleting. The temptation to chase past returns. But whatever returns each sector ETF may earn, the investors in those narrow ETFs will likely, if not certainly, earn returns that fall well behind them. There is abundant evidence that the most popular sector funds of the day are those that have recently enjoyed the most spectacular recent performance. But such success does not endure. Again, remember reversion to the mean, RTM. In fact, such after-the-fact popularity is a recipe for unsuccessful investing. That was the lesson of Chapter 7, that mutual fund investors almost always do significantly worse than the funds they own, and do still worse when they choose funds that are less diversified and more volatile. That pattern is likely to be repeated, even magnified, in ETFs. Among the 20 best-performing ETFs, for 19 funds, investor returns fell short of ETF returns. To illustrate this point, consider the records of the 20 best-performing ETFs during 2003 to 2006. Only one ETF earned a better return for its shareholders than the return reported by the ETF itself. The average shortfall in shareholder returns was equal to 5 percentage points per year, with the largest gap fully 14 percentage points. iShares Austria reported a return of 42%, but its investors earned just 28%. Handle with care should be the first warning on the ETF label, though I have yet to see it used. Or perhaps, caution, performance chasing at work. A double whammy, betting on hot market sectors, emotions, and paying heavy costs, expenses, are sure to be hazardous to your wealth. And so we have a double whammy. Investors who choose or are persuaded by their brokers to actively trade ETFs face the near inevitability of counterproductive market timing, as investors bet on sectors as they grow hot, and bet against them when they grow cold. Second, those heavy commissions and fees accumulate over time, as expenses take a growing toll on ETF returns. Together, these two enemies of the equity investor, emotions and expenses, are sure to be hazardous to your wealth, to say nothing of consuming giant globs of time that you could easily use in more productive and enjoyable ways. Beginning in 2006, ETFs became the cutting edge of the alleged market-beating strategies that I'll describe in the next chapter. The entrepreneurs and marketers of these so-called smart beta strategies seem to believe that their fundamental indexing and factor approaches are winning long-term strategies. Yet, by choosing the ETF format, they strongly imply that bringing stockbrokers into the distribution mix and encouraging investors to actively buy and sell their ETFs will lead to even larger short-term profits. I doubt it. ETFs are a dream come true for entrepreneurs and brokers. But are they an investor's dream come true? ETFs are clearly a dream come true for entrepreneurs, stockbrokers, and fund managers. But is it too much to ask whether these exchange-traded index funds are an investor's dream come true? Do investors really benefit from being able to trade ETFs all day long in real time? Is less diversification better than more diversification? Is trend following a winner's game or a loser's game? Are ETFs truly low-cost vehicles after we add their brokerage commissions and taxes on short-term profits to their expense ratios? Is buy and sell, often with great frequency, really a better strategy than buy and hold? Finally, if the traditional index fund was designed to capitalize on the wisdom of long-term investing, aren't investors in these exchange-traded index funds too often engaging in the folly of short-term speculation? Doesn't your own common sense give you the answers to these questions? The interests of the business versus the interests of the clients. On the broad spectrum that lies between advancing the interests of those in the investment business and the interest of their clients, where do ETFs fit? If you are making a single large initial purchase of either of those two versions of classic indexing, the Vanguard 500 ETF or the Spider 500 ETF, at a low commission rate and holding the shares for the long term, you'll profit from the broad diversification and the low expense ratios that both offer. You may even enjoy a bit of extra tax efficiency from these broad market ETFs. But if you trade these two ETFs, you're defying the relentless rules of humble arithmetic that are the key to successful investing. And if you like the idea of sector ETFs, invest in the appropriate ones and don't trade them. Answering my question. Let me now answer the question I asked at the outset of this chapter. What have they done to my song, Ma? As the creator of the world's first traditional index fund all those years ago, as I observe the ETF phenomenon, I can only answer, they've tied it up in a plastic bag and turned it upside down, Ma. That's what they've done to my song. In short, the ETF is a traitor to the cause of the TIF. I urge intelligent investors to stay the course with the proven index strategy. While I can't assure you that traditional index investing is the best strategy ever devised, I can assure you that the number of strategies that are worse is infinite. Don't take my word for it. In an essay entitled Indexing Goes Hollywood, here's what Don Phillips, managing director of Morningstar, has said. There is a dark side to indexing that investors should not ignore. The potential for harm to investors increases as index offerings become more specialized, which is exactly what has happened in the world of ETFs. In the right hands, precision tools can create great things. In the wrong ones, however, they can do considerable damage. In creating more complex offerings, the index community has found new revenue sources from very specialized tools. But it has done so at the risk of doing considerable harm to less sophisticated investors. The test of character facing the index community is whether it ignores that risk or steps up and tries to mitigate it. The continued good name of indexing lies in the balance. From Jim Wyant, founder of ETF.com, ironically formerly named IndexUniverse.com, I have always found it ironic that indexing, like almost everything else in the world of finance, comes in waves. Hedge fund indexes, microcap indexes, dividend indexes, commodities indexes, China indexes, and enhanced indexes are all flavors of the month. And I'll give you three guesses as to what all these indexes have in common. One, chasing returns. Two, chasing returns. Or three, chasing returns. If you believe in indexing, then you know that there is no free money. Ultimately, the push toward enhanced indexing is about enhancing the bottom line for managers. But it's important for us to keep our eyes on the ball and remember what makes indexing, well, indexing. Low fees, broad diversification, hold, hold, hold. Don't believe the hype. Try to beat the market in any manner, and you're likely to get beaten. By about the cost of doing it. And now listen carefully to the candid warnings from two senior officers of a major ETF sponsor. Chief Executive. For most people, sector funds don't make a lot of sense. Don't stray too far from the market's course. Chief Investment Officer. It would be unfortunate if people focused pinpoint bets on very narrowly defined ETFs. These still involve nearly as much risk as concentrating on individual stock picks. You're taking extraordinary risk. It's possible to take a good thing too far. How many people really need them? Chapter 16. Index funds that promise to beat the market. The new paradigm? Since the inception of the first index mutual fund in 1975, traditional index funds, TIFs, designed for the long-term investor, have proved to be both a remarkable artistic success and an incredible commercial success. In previous chapters, we've demonstrated, pretty much unequivocally, the success of index funds in providing long-term returns to investors that have vastly surpassed the returns achieved by investors in actively managed mutual funds. Given that artistic success, the commercial success of indexing is hardly surprising. Although it was a long time coming, the principles of the original S&P 500 index model have stood the test of time. Today, the lion's share of the assets of TIFs are those that track the broad U.S. stock market, the S&P 500, or the total stock market index, the broad international stock market, and the broad U.S. bond market. Assets of these traditional stock index funds have soared from $16 million in 1976 to $2 trillion in early 2017. 20% of the assets of all equity mutual funds. Assets of traditional bond index funds have also soared from $132 million in 1986 to $407 billion in 2017. 13% of the assets of all taxable bond funds. Since 2009, TIF assets have grown at an 18% annual rate, slightly faster than their ETF cousins. Success breeds competition. In many arenas, indexing has become a competitive field. The largest managers of TIFs are engaged in fiercely competitive price wars, cutting their expense ratios to draw the assets of investors who are smart enough to realize that costs make the difference. This trend is great for index fund investors, but it slashes the profits of index fund managers and discourages entrepreneurs who start new fund ventures in the hopes of enriching themselves by building fund empires. The Vanguard funds operate on an at-cost basis, so it is largely economies of scale rather than competition that reduce the expenses borne by its index fund shareholders. Passive ETF strategies designed to outpace stock market returns. How then have index fund promoters taken advantage of the proven attributes that underlie the success of the TIF? Why, they create new indexes and join the exchange-traded fund ETF parade. Then they claim, or at least strongly imply, that their new index strategies will consistently outpace the broad market indexes that up until now have pretty much defined how we think about indexing. ETF managers charge a higher fee for that higher potential reward, whether or not it is ever actually delivered. Usually not. Offering the promise of earning excess returns, a whole host of ETFs have sprung up to entice investors and speculators alike. Active managers versus active strategies. Let's consider the difference between the approaches of traditional active money managers and the approach of ETF managers. Active managers know that the only way to beat the market portfolio is to depart from the market portfolio. And this is what active managers strive to do individually. Collectively, they can't succeed, for their trading merely shifts ownership from one holder to another. All of that swapping of stock certificates back and forth, however it may work out for a given buyer or seller, in the aggregate, it enriches only our financial intermediaries. But active managers have a vested financial interest in making the case that if they have done well in the past, they will continue to do so in the future. And if they haven't done well in the past, well, better days are always ahead. Sponsors of ETFs, on the other hand, make no claim to prescience. Rather, most rely on one of these two strategies. One, offer broad market index funds that investors can profitably trade in real time. This seems to be a specious claim. Two, create indexes for a wide range of narrow market sectors that investors can swap back and forth, earning extra profits. In fact, the evidence goes the other way. So what's happening is that the responsibility for investment management and portfolio strategy is being shifted from active fund managers to active mutual fund investors. This crucial shift has broad implications for Main Street investors. I confess to being skeptical that this change will serve investors well. The new breed of passive indexers are active strategists. The new breed of passive indexers have largely chosen the ETF structure to market their products. It's an easy market to enter. In recent years, smart beta ETFs, whatever exactly that means, have become a hot product. Smart beta managers create their own indexes. Not, in fact, indexes in the traditional sense, but active strategies claiming to be indexes. They focus on weighting portfolios by so-called factors, stocks with similar forces driving their returns. Rather than weighting portfolio holdings by their market capitalizations, they may focus on a single factor, value, momentum, size, etc. Or they may use a combination of factors, such as corporate revenues, cash flows, profits, and dividends. One smart beta ETF portfolio, for example, is weighted by the dollar amount of dividends distributed by each corporation, rather than weighted by the market capitalizations of its components. Not a terrible idea, but not a world-changing one either. As a concept, smart beta is not a terrible idea, nor is it a world-changing one. Smart beta ETF managers rely on computers to parse heavily mined past data on stocks that will enable fund managers to identify factors that can be easily packaged as ETFs. The goal is to create great profits for the manager by gathering the assets of investors seeking a performance edge. Mark me as from Missouri on these strategies. Of course it seems easy, but it isn't. Consistently outpacing the market is difficult, in part because of the power of reversion to the mean in mutual fund returns. Today's winning factors are all too likely to be tomorrow's losing factors. Investors who disregard RTM are all too likely making a huge mistake. Remembrance of things past. With the rise of ETFs, once again remember the go-go fund craze of 1965 to 1968 and the Nifty 50 craze of 1970 to 1973. popular fads are driving product creation in the fund industry. These products are great for fund sponsors, but almost always awful for fund investors. Let me remind you of this time-honored principle. Successful short-term marketing strategies are rarely, if ever, optimal long-term investment strategies. And this will not surprise you. The fundamental factors that ETF entrepreneurs typically identify as the basis for their portfolio strategies have actually outpaced the traditional indexes in the past. We call this data mining. You can be sure that no one would have the temerity to promote a new strategy that has lagged the traditional index fund in the past. But in investing, the past is rarely prologue to the future. Recent events confirm skepticism about the power of smart beta. Nonetheless, the assets of these smart beta ETFs, renamed Strategic Beta by Morningstar, have ballooned from $100 billion in 2006 to more than $750 billion currently. They have accounted for a remarkable 26% of mutual fund industry cash flows during the first 4 months of 2017. At the same time, the two major strategic beta styles, value and growth, have done a U-turn. During 2016, the value index rose 16.9%, while the growth index provided a far smaller 6.2% gain. But so far in 2017, through April, the growth index has leaped by 12.2%, while the value index has struggled to earn a 3.3% gain. Yes, both are short periods to evaluate factor strategies. But perhaps unsurprisingly, it seems that RTM has struck once again. The new Copernicans? The members of this new breed of smart beta ETF indexers are not shy about their prescience. They claim variously, if a tad grandiosely, that they represent a new wave in indexing, a revolution that will offer investors a new paradigm, a combination of higher returns and lower risk. Indeed, the believers in factor-based indexes have described themselves as the new Copernicans, after the 16th century astronomer who concluded that the center of our solar system was not the Earth, but the Sun. They compared traditional market cap-weighted indexers with ancient astronomers who attempted to perpetuate the Ptolemaic view of an Earth-centered universe. And they assured the world that we're at the brink of a huge paradigm shift in indexing. Over the past decade, smart beta has represented a small paradigm shift, but even its earliest advocate, the so-called godfather of smart beta, recently described a smart beta crash as reasonably likely. I doubt it. Let's look at the record. Over the past decade, both the original fundamental index fund and the first dividend-weighted index fund have had the opportunity to prove the value of their theories. What have they proven? Essentially, nothing. Exhibit 16.1, referred to in the accompanying PTF, presents the comparisons. You'll note that the fundamental index fund earned higher returns while assuming higher risk than the S&P 500 fund. The dividend index, on the other hand, earned lower returns and carried lower risk. But when we calculate the risk-adjusted Sharpe ratio, the S&P 500 index fund wins in both comparisons. The similarity of returns and risks in all three funds should not be surprising. Each holds a diversified portfolio with similar stocks, simply weighted differently. In fact, given the remarkably high correlation of 0.97 of both smart beta ETFs with the returns earned by the S&P 500, both could easily be classified as high-priced closet index funds. What the S&P 500 index portfolio offers is the certainty that its investors will earn nearly the entire return of the stock market index. These two smart beta ETFs may also do that. We just don't know. You must ask yourself these questions. Among similar portfolios, do I prefer a certain relative outcome or an uncertain one? Is it better to be safe than sorry? Only you can decide. When an active manager of an equity fund claims to have a way of uncovering extra value in our highly, but not perfectly, efficient U.S. stock market, investors will look at the past record, consider the strategies, and invest or not. Many of these new smart beta ETF managers are in fact active managers, but they not only claim prescience, but a prescience that gives them confidence that certain sectors of the market, such as dividend-paying stocks, will outperform the broad index as far ahead as the eye can see. That thesis defies reason and the lessons of history. The greatest enemy of a good plan is the dream of a perfect plan. Stick to the good plan. Traditional market cap-weighted index funds, such as the Standard & Poor's 500, guarantee that you will receive your fair share of stock market returns and virtually assure that you will outperform, over the long term, at least 90% of the other investors in the marketplace. Maybe this new paradigm of factor indexing, unlike all the other new paradigms that I've seen, will work. But maybe it won't. I urge you not to be tempted by the siren song of paradigms that promise the accumulation of wealth that are far beyond the rewards of the traditional index fund. Don't forget the prophetic warning of Karl von Clausewitz, military theorist and Prussian general of the early 19th century. The greatest enemy of a good plan is the dream of a perfect plan. Put your dreaming away, pull out your common sense, and stick to the good plan represented by the traditional index fund. Don't take my word for it. I feel strongly on this point, but I am not alone. First, hear these words from Gregory Mankiw, Harvard professor and former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers during the George W. Bush administration, speaking about the competition between traditional index funds and smart beta. I am placing my bets with Bogle on this one. He was right. Then listen to William Sharp, professor of finance at Stanford University and Nobel laureate in economics. Smart beta is stupid. It is quite remarkable that people think that somehow a scheme that weights stocks differently than capitalization can dominate a capitalization-weighted index. New paradigms come and go. Betting against the market, and spending a considerable amount of money to do so, is indeed likely to be a hazardous undertaking. Finally, consider this affirmation of traditional indexing from Wharton School professor Jeremy Siegel, author of Stocks for the Long Run and advisor to Wisdom Tree Investments, the promoter of the dividend-driven factor model. It can be shown that maximum diversification is achieved by holding each stock in proportion to its value to the entire market. Hindsight plays tricks in our minds, often distorts the past and encourages us to play hunches and outguess other investors, who in turn are playing the same game. For most of us, trying to beat the market leads to disastrous results. Our actions lead to much lower returns than can be achieved by just staying in the market, matching the market year after year with index funds, such as the Vanguard 500 portfolio, and Vanguard's Total Stock Market Index Fund. This quotation is from the first edition of Dr. Siegel's book in 1994. I understand that he has every right to change his mind. Chapter 17. What would Benjamin Graham have thought about indexing? Mr. Buffett confirms Mr. Graham's endorsement of the index fund. The first edition of The Intelligent Investor was published in 1949. It was written by Benjamin Graham, the most respected money manager of his era. The Intelligent Investor is regarded as the best book of its kind, comprehensive, analytical, perceptive, and forthright, a book for the ages. Although Benjamin Graham is best known for his focus on the kind of value investing represented by the category of stocks he described as bargain issues, he cautioned, "The aggressive investor must have a considerable knowledge of security values, enough, in fact, to warrant viewing his security operations as equivalent to a business enterprise, armed with mental weapons that distinguish him from the trading public. It follows from this reasoning that the majority of security owners should elect the defensive classification." Investors should be satisfied with the reasonably good return obtainable from a defensive portfolio. Why? Because the majority of investors do not have the time or the determination or the mental equipment to embark upon such investing as a quasi-business. They should therefore be satisfied with the reasonably good return obtainable from a defensive portfolio. And they should stoutly resist the recurrent temptation to increase this return by deviating into other paths. The first index mutual fund was not formed until 1974, a quarter century after The Intelligent Investor was published in 1949. But Graham was presciently describing the essence of that precedent-setting fund. Coincidentally, it was also in 1949 that an article in Fortune magazine introduced me to the mutual fund industry, inspiring me to write my 1951 Princeton senior thesis on mutual funds. There, I first hinted at the index fund idea. Mutual funds can make no claim to superiority over the market averages. For the defensive investor who required assistance, Graham originally recommended professional investment advisors who rely on normal investment experience for their results, and who make no claim to being brilliant, but pride themselves on being careful, conservative, and competent, whose chief value to their clients is in shielding them from costly mistakes. Graham cautioned investors not to expect too much from stock exchange houses, arguing that the Wall Street business fraternity is still feeling its way toward the high standards and standing of a profession. A half century later, the quest remains far from complete. Wall Street, a Falstaffian joke. He also noted, profoundly if obviously, that Wall Street is in business to make commissions, and that the way to succeed in business is to give customers what they want, trying hard to make money in a field where they are condemned almost by mathematical law to lose. Later on, in 1976, Graham described his opinion of Wall Street as highly unfavorable, a Falstaffian joke that frequently degenerates into a madhouse, a huge laundry in which institutions take in large blocks of each other's washing. Shades of the ideas of two of the top managers of university endowment funds, Jack Meyer, formerly of Harvard, and David Swensen of Yale, both of whom we heard from earlier. In that first edition of The Intelligent Investor, Graham commended the use by investors of leading investment funds as an alternative to creating their own portfolios. Graham described the well-established mutual funds of his era as competently managed, making fewer mistakes than the typical small investor, carrying a reasonable expense, and performing a sound function by acquiring and holding an adequately diversified list of common stocks. The truth about mutual fund managers. Graham was bluntly realistic about what fund managers might accomplish. He illustrated this point in his book with data showing that from 1937 through 1947, when the Standard & Poor's 500 Index provided a total return of 57%, the average mutual fund produced a total return of 54%, excluding the oppressive impact of sales loads. The more things change, the more they remain the same. Graham's conclusion: the figures are not very impressive in either direction. On the whole, the managerial ability of invested funds has been just about able to absorb the expense burden and the drag of uninvested cash. In 1949, however, fund expenses and turnover costs were remarkably far lower than in the modern fund industry. That change helps explain why, as fund returns were overwhelmed by these costs in recent decades, the figures were impressive in a negative rather than a positive direction. Unsoundly managed funds can produce spectacular but largely illusionary profits for a while, followed inevitably by calamitous losses. By 1965, Graham's confidence that funds would produce the market's return, less costs, was shaken. Unsoundly managed funds, he noted in the 1973 edition of The Intelligent Investor, can produce spectacular but largely illusionary profits for a while, followed inevitably by calamitous losses. He was describing the so-called performance funds of the mid-1960s go-go era, in which a new breed that had a spectacular knack for coming up with winners funds managed by bright, energetic young people who promised to perform miracles with other people's money, but who have inevitably brought losses to their public in the end. Graham could have as easily been presciently describing the hundreds of risky new economy mutual funds formed during the great technology stock-driven bull market of the late 1990s and the utter collapse in their asset values, far worse than the 50% market crash that followed. Referred to Exhibit 7.2 in Chapter 7 in the accompanying PDF. The real money in investments will have to be made not out of buying and selling, but of owning and holding securities for their dividends and benefiting from their long-term increase in value. Graham's timeless lessons for the intelligent investor are as valid today as when he prescribed them in his first edition. Benjamin Graham's timeless message, the real money in investment will have to be made, as most of it has been made in the past, not out of buying and selling, but of owning and holding securities, receiving interest and dividends, and benefiting from their long-term increase in value. Graham's philosophy has been reflected over and over again in this book, best exemplified in the parable of the Gottrocks family in Chapter 1, and the distinction between the real market of corporate intrinsic value and the expectations market of ephemeral stock prices described in Chapter 2. The Graham 1949 strategy, precursor to the 1976 index fund. Owning and holding a diversified list of securities? Wouldn't Graham recommend a fund that essentially buys the entire stock market and holds it forever, patiently receiving interest and dividends and increases in value? Doesn't his admonition to strictly adhere to standard, conservative, and even unimaginative forms of investment eerily echo the concept of the stock market index fund? When he advises the defensive investor to emphasize diversification more than individual selection, has not Benjamin Graham come within inches of describing the modern-day stock index fund? The failure of investment managers. Late in his life, in an interview published in 1976, Graham candidly acknowledged the inevitable failure of individual investment managers to outpace the market. Coincidentally, the interview took place at almost the very moment in August 1976, when the public offering of the world's first mutual index fund, First Index Investment Trust, now Vanguard 500 Index Fund, was taking place. The interviewer asked Graham, "Can the average manager obtain better results than the Standard & Poor's Index over the years?" Graham's blunt response, "No." Then he explained, "In effect, that would mean that the stock market experts as a whole could beat themselves. A logical contradiction. There is no evidence that professional experts earn higher returns than individual amateurs, nor that any class of institutional investor, for example, pension managers or mutual fund managers, earns higher returns than any other class. I see no reason why they, investors, should be content with results inferior to those of an indexed fund." Then he was asked whether investors should be content with earning the market's return. Graham's answer, "Yes." All these years later, the central theme of this little book is enabling investors to earn their fair share of the stock market's return. Only the low-cost traditional index fund can guarantee that outcome. In the same interview, Benjamin Graham was asked about the objection made to the index fund, that different investors have different requirements. Again, he responded bluntly, "At bottom, that is only a convenient cliché or alibi to justify the mediocre record of the past. All investors want good results from their investments and are entitled to them to the extent that they are actually obtainable. I see no reason why they should be content with results inferior to those of an indexed fund or pay standard fees for such inferior results." The down-to-earth basics of portfolio policy. The name Benjamin Graham is intimately connected, indeed almost synonymous, with value investing and the search for undervalued securities. But his classic book gives far more attention to the down-to-earth basics of portfolio policy, The straightforward, uncomplicated principles of diversification and rational long-term expectations. Also, overarching themes of this little book that you are now listening to. Then to solving the Sphinx-like riddle of selecting superior stocks through careful security analysis. Finding superior value was once a rewarding activity, but no longer. Graham was well aware that the superior rewards he had personally reaped by using his valuation principles would be difficult to achieve in the future. In that 1976 interview, he made this remarkable concession. "I am no longer an advocate of elaborate techniques of security analysis in order to find superior value opportunities. This was a rewarding activity, say, 40 years ago, but the situation has changed a great deal since then. In the old days, any well-trained security analyst could do a good professional job of selecting undervalued issues through detailed studies. But in the light of the enormous amount of research now being carried on, I doubt whether in most cases such extensive efforts will generate sufficiently superior selections to justify their cost." It is fair to say that by Graham's demanding standards, the overwhelming majority of today's mutual funds, largely because of their high costs and speculative behavior, have failed to live up to their promise. As a result, the traditional index fund has now moved toward ascendancy in investor preferences. Why? Both because of what it does, providing the broadest possible diversification, and because of what it doesn't do, neither assessing high management fees nor engaging in high portfolio turnover. These paraphrases of Graham's copybook maxims are an important part of his legacy to that vast majority of shareholders who, he believed, should follow the principles he outlined for the defensive investor. To achieve satisfactory investment results is easier than most people realize. It is Benjamin Graham's common sense, intelligence, clear thinking, simplicity, and sense of financial history, along with his willingness to hold fast to the sound principles of long-term investing, that constitute his lasting legacy. He sums up his advice. "Fortunately for the typical investor, it is by no means necessary for his success that he bring the time-honored qualities of courage, knowledge, judgment, and experience to bear upon his program, provided he limits his ambition to his capacity and confines his activities within the safe and narrow path of standard defensive investment. To achieve satisfactory investment results is easier than most people realize. To achieve superior results is harder than it looks." When it's so easy, in fact unbelievably simple, to capture the stock market's returns through an index fund, you don't need to assume extra risks, nor the burden of excessive costs to earn superior results. With Benjamin Graham's long perspective, common sense, hard realism, and wise intellect, there is no doubt whatsoever in my mind that he would have applauded the index fund. Indeed, as you'll read in Warren Buffett's words that follow, that's precisely what he did. Don't take my word for it. While Benjamin Graham's clearly written commentary can easily be read as an endorsement of a low-cost, all-stock market index fund, don't take my word for it. Listen instead to Warren Buffett, his protege and collaborator, whose counsel and practical aid Graham acknowledged as invaluable in the final edition of The Intelligent Investor. In 1993, Buffett unequivocally endorsed the index fund. In 2006, he went even further, not only reaffirming this endorsement, but personally assuring me that, decades earlier, Graham himself had endorsed the index fund. Mr. Buffett spoke these words directly to me at a dinner in Omaha in 2006. "A low-cost index fund is the most sensible equity investment for the great majority of investors. My mentor, Ben Graham, took this position many years ago, and everything I have seen since convinces me of its truth. I can only add, after Forrest Gump, and that's all I have to say about that." Chapter 18. Asset Allocation 1. Stocks and Bonds. When you begin to invest, as you accumulate assets, when you retire. In this chapter and the next, we tackle two complex issues: the general principles of asset allocation and allocation funds specifically designed for your retirement years. These are issues that have no easy answers. Why? First, because we investors have a wide range of investment goals, risk tolerances, and behavioral characteristics. Second, because we've had 35 years of extraordinary returns in the stock market and the bond market alike, returns that are highly unlikely to recur in the coming decade. See Chapter 9, When the Good Times No Longer Roll. Third, authors of books on investing are, in a real sense, captives of the eras that we have experienced. For example, when Benjamin Graham wrote The Intelligent Investor in 1949, he had never experienced a year in which the interest rate on bonds exceeded the dividend yield on stocks. By way of contrast, as I write this chapter in 2017, I have witnessed 60 consecutive years in which the dividend yield on stocks has never exceeded the interest rate on bonds. Turnabout, it seems, is fair play. So instead of looking back and mining the voluminous data on past returns and risks on stocks and bonds, I'll discuss clear principles that you can apply in your current situation. Whether you are accumulating investment assets during your working years or are making withdrawals from your assets in your retirement years, I hope to help you establish appropriate asset allocations for your future. 94% of the differences in portfolio returns is explained by asset allocation. Benjamin Graham believed that your first investment decision should be how to allocate your investment assets. How much should you hold in stocks? How much in bonds? Graham believed that this strategic decision may well be the most important of your investment lifetime. A landmark 1986 academic study confirmed his view. The study found that asset allocation accounted for an astonishing 94% of the differences in total returns achieved by institutionally managed pension funds. That 94% figure suggests that long-term fund investors might profit by concentrating more on the allocation of their investments between stock funds and bond funds, and less on the question of which particular funds to hold. Benjamin Graham's standard division, 50-50. Where do we begin? Let's start with Benjamin Graham's advice regarding asset allocation in his 1949 classic, The Intelligent Investor. We have suggested as a fundamental guiding rule that the investor should never have less than 25% or more than 75% of his funds in common stocks, with a consequent inverse range of between 75% and 25% in bonds. There is an implication here that the standard division should be an equal one, or 50-50, between the two major investment mediums. Furthermore, a truly conservative investor will be satisfied with the gains shown on half his portfolio in a rising market, while in a severe decline, he may derive much solace, a la Rochefoucauld, from reflecting how much better off he is than many of his more venturesome friends. An apparent reference to the maxim, we all have strength enough to endure the misfortunes of others. Asset allocations and differences in yields. To today's investors and their advisors, that 50-50 stock bond allocation and that range of 75-25 to 25-75 may well seem too conservative. But in 1949, when Graham wrote his book, the yield on stocks was 6.9%, and the yield on bonds was 1.9%. Today, stock yields are 2.0%, and bond yields are 3.1%. A world of difference in deciding on how much to allocate to stocks and to bonds. The bond yield represents a portfolio consisting of one-half corporate bonds, 3.9%, and one-half U.S. Treasury 10-year notes, 2.3%. That difference can be measured in two major ways. One, the gross income yield on a 50-50 stock bond portfolio has dropped by fully 40%, from 4.4% to 2.6%. Two, the yield tables have been turned upside down, with stocks providing an annual yield premium of 5.0% in 1949, amazing, and a yield discount of 1.1% in 2017. When I discussed Graham's philosophy in my 1993 book, Bogle on Mutual Funds, New Perspectives for the Intelligent Investor, the use of just two asset classes was my starting point. My recommendations for investors in the accumulation phase of their lives